Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, July 24th. I'm Alan Chartok. Underwriting support for Medical Monday comes from Vision Excel Eye Care, Lake Katrine, Exams, Eye Care, Dry Eye Therapy, and now new American-made frames where eyewear is an art. VisionExcelEyeCare.com. Joining us today is the wonderful, my pal, Dr. Paul Lemansky of the Capital Care Center for Preventative Medicine in Albany. It's going to be a busy hour. He's always popular, so be sure to get your calls in early. The number is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Lemansky and your calls and much more all coming up on the Vox Pop right after this news. Hello, hello, hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Dr. Paul Lemansky, my friend, joins us today to respond to your questions and comments. He comes to us from the Capital Care Center for Preventive Medicine. Dr. Lemansky is board-certified internist with a master's degree in human nutrition. He's a graduate of New York Medical College, also served as director for the Center for Preventive Medicine and Cardiovascular Health, and as clinical chief for cardiovascular health for Kaiser Permanente's Northeast Division. Dr. Lemansky, Paul, thank you so much for coming back to Medical Monday.
Absolutely.
The number to call, ladies and gentlemen, and there's one call already, is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. So, Paul, I know you're always interested in new things, and you've been writing, and I know your latest piece is not published yet, but give us a little hint as to what's in it.
Well, you know, I think it's becoming increasingly obvious that it's becoming more and more expensive to take care of folks and to keep them healthy and to keep them from having the consequences of chronic disease process. But you know, Alan, back in 1993, there was a paper published in JAMA which looked at what the causes of death were for in the United States for the preceding 10 years, and what it is looking to see what were the disease processes that were causing death in the United States. And it turned out that the root cause of the deaths that occurred were not really disease processes in what we would normally think of. The root causes had to do with behavior, had to do with lifestyle, had to do with the way that people live their lives. So, for example, inactivity, smoking, increase in body weight, all those contributed to the diseases that ultimately killed people in the United States. 80% of the chronic diseases in the United States are caused by such conditions, where we have some volitional control. Now, granted, not everybody is going to be able to, you know, lower their cholesterol by simply eating a lower cholesterol diet and a lower saturated fat diet. But by and large, 80% of the diseases that I see people as an internist for every single day, hypertension, high cholesterol, sleep apnea, diabetes, pre-diabetes. 80% of these things can be addressed with lifestyle and are preventable. And that's, I think, the big news, given that, you know, everybody in Washington is so concerned about how much it's costing us to take care of everyone. Well, if we prevented 80% of the problems that were out there with the actions that individuals could take in their own lives, then we could possibly float the boat for everybody and not have to. I think ultimately we're going to be talking about, you know, care being restricted in some ways, you know, and denied in some ways in order to be able to balance the ledger.
Okay, so the lines are loading up already, Paul. So let me ask you very quickly. Give us an example of one. Let's take diabetes, pre-diabetes.
Okay.
Or diabetes.
So we can identify people who are pre-diabetic. Some people we identify on the basis of their family history. Someone in their family, especially a first-degree relative, has diabetes, puts them at risk. Then that individual may have an elevated blood sugar. If they additionally are increase in body weight, if we get to them to lose just 5 to 7% of their body weight, I'm not talking about 30 pounds. I'm talking about 14, 15 pounds, 18 pounds. We get them to lose 5 to 7% of their body weight. We decrease conversion from someone with pre-diabetes to actual diabetes by 60%.
Wow.
That's dramatic. It's remarkable, actually.
But here's the problem. I know guys right here who smoke. What can we do about that? We say, don't smoke. You're killing yourself. You know, you're going to do this, that. But they are addicted and they do it. I know people who have full-blown diabetes who know very well if they lost the weight, they would be all right. In fact, I went on the air the other day and got into big trouble because I mentioned my pet theory, which, of course, you will agree that is pet theory, that after the stomach stapling, they're finding that people lose their diabetes. In other words, they take the fat out. When the fat's removed, there's no diabetes.
Well, that's not rigorously true, Alan.
It isn't?
No.
I read it in
what
the paper.
Can you always believe what you read?
I read it in the paper.
Well, so they don't lose their diabetes. What they do is they are able to control their diabetes without medication.
No, sir.
Yeah.
No, sir. What I read in the paper was...
Paper's wrong. Here's what happens with type 2 diabetes, okay? Here's what happens with a type 2 diabetic. They have a genetic predisposition. They're overweight or obese. Over time, they have to increase the amount of insulin. So as they become resistant to the effects of their insulin, they have to increase the amount of insulin in order to keep their blood sugar down. They do that by working the cells, and I would say overworking the cells in their pancreas that produce insulin. Okay, they overwork those cells to the extent where those cells start to die. They burn out. So by the time you're actually diagnosed with diabetes, you've lost 50 to 70% of the cells that produce insulin. And it's a totally silent process.
Just because...
You don't get them back by having a gastric bypass done.
No. Okay. All right. You're the expert, not me. But I'm going to ask you a question. What about the fact that you've lost those cells? Can you get them back if you lose the weight?
No.
Uh-huh.
See, but you don't require as much insulin if you lose the weight, so you're able to get by on whatever little bit that you make.
I got it. Okay, we got a lot of calls. We'll go first to Jim. Jim, you're on first, but you got to go quick. Go ahead.
And in general, how effective is the shingles vaccine?
Well, I think the shingles vaccine is quite effective, and I think it's a worthwhile thing for individuals to do. If you ever had a family member or a friend who had shingles, it can be extremely painful and it could damage you. I mean, you get it in the distribution of your eye, and I'm sure you could appreciate that that would be a very serious complication. So, I'm all in favor of the shingles vaccine, even for individuals, by the way, who've had shingles.
Really?
It works for individuals who've had shingles, so you don't get another episode or a decreased likelihood of getting another episode of shingles. You can have it multiple times.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Jim. Okay, now let's go to Harriet in Woodstock. Okay, Harriet in Woodstock, you're on.
Hi, hello. My question is about tooth enamel. I have fairly recently seen the enamel on my teeth is especially along the edge that contacts the gums has just been getting ridged and weird and chipping off my teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And I have asked four different dentists and have received no answer.
Well, ma'am, I'm not a dentist, so I couldn't. And of course, you'd need to be examined to know for certain that that's indeed what was going on. But do you eat acidic foods? Do you eat a lot of lemons, as an example?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Well, I was looking at it not as much as it's reflecting in my teeth, but it's obviously a dietary or some kind of physical change. I don't eat, I don't drink soft drinks. I don't eat acidic
Has someone, and not to interrupt you, but has someone told you that you're losing tooth enamel?
Well, no, they don't have to. I can see it. Well, and feel it with my, you know, I can see the areas where it's come off.
Well, what about acid reflux?
That could
do
it.
Oh, no, I don't have
you
that.
You could have acid, but that's refluxing pretty high up. You would taste that.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Okay, you got to go back to the dentist. Thanks, Harriet. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. And very quickly, we'll go to Lee in New Paltz. Okay, Lee, you're on.
Hi.
Go ahead, Lee.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
We're good.
Hi, I just have a question. Back in October, I was tested for Lyme, was told after a tick bite and a ring that I did not have it. About 3 months ago, I started getting symptoms. I went back to the doctor. They tested me again and said that I had two bands. So they put me on antibiotics because my symptoms were getting increasingly worse. Now, I've heard different things about you have to have a certain amount of bands before they'll say you're positive. They did put me on a doxycycline for a month. Is there anything else I can do besides that, alternative-wise, or
well,
other than the antibiotic?
You know, I mean, 21 days of doxycycline is usually considered a full treatment for Lyme disease.
Okay.
Most people are not going to treat. Now, you're in New Paltz, so...
Yes.
Things are a little different down in the Hudson Valley, and doctors treat things a little differently down there than they do up in Albany. But, you know, in the medical literature, 21 days is sufficient for treating Lyme. The screening test that's typically done is something called an ELISA test, and the confirmatory test. So if that's positive, there's a confirmatory test done called a Western blot, and that's where they'll...
Which is what I had.
Right. They count up the number of bands. Generally speaking, that's reasonably accurate. So you need to know that there are different immunoglobulin classes in your bloodstream that respond to the organism, IgG and IgM. Usually what you'll see is the IgM first, subsequently then you'll see IgG. So if you have only... IgG banding, then that's indicative of an old infection. If you have IgM banding, that's indicative of a new one. So you need to make sure that you understand and they understand which one is manifest.
But we have to go to a break, but very quickly. But then maybe what Lee's got are some of the other diseases that come with a tick.
Well, Alan's referring to about four different, you know, types of diseases that can sometimes be seen with transmitted through ticks.
Now, how would I know that?
You'd have to be tested.
What would I test?
You'd have to be tested specifically for them, you know. But they're going to have different. They're not always going to have the same symptoms as Lyme. So, you know, Babesia and Ehrlichia and anaplasmosis are the other three typically around here that you might see that could be tested for.
And then there's and then there's this terrible one, right? The viral one.
The Panessa with three cases in Saratoga County is a little bit concerning.
And what are the symptoms for that?
That's more of a viral. That's more of a neurological, you know, like an encephalitis type of picture. So alteration in mental status, fever, headache, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Lee, got to let you go. Thank you very much for calling.
All right. Thank you so much.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York, sales and service of Audi, BMW, Mercedes, Volvo, Saab, Volkswagen, and Porsche, QFCC.com. Sheehy Opticians Albany providing eye exams and eyeglasses, including Bevel, LaFont, and ProDesign. Progressive lenses from Verilux and Nikon at Maui Jim, Costa, and Ray-Ban sunglasses. SHEEHYOpticians.com. Villa Veritas Foundation, Kerhonkson, New York, honoring founder Jim Cusack, continuing his work for over four decades and four generations, helping the chemically dependent and their families battle addiction. VillaVeritas.org. And from Nathan LaTower Hospital, Gloversville, New York, now offering dialysis, NLH.org.
We're back, and we're back with you. Delighted to be here. Let's go to Bill in Amherst, Massachusetts. Have I ever told you I love Amherst? Okay. You're on, Bill. Go ahead.
Yes, doctors. Thank you for taking my call. I recently turned 65 and had my annual physical, and my PSA was slightly elevated.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if there's any hard evidence that the diet and nutrition can make a difference. I'm not overweight by any stretch of the imagination. Nearly a vegetarian.
Yeah.
Already.
Well, there is. I think Dean Ornish of who is a internist out in Sausalito, who did an original study back in the early 1990s, proving that lifestyle change alone, including a vegan diet, could cause reversal of cholesterol plaque in the arteries of your heart. Dean Ornish then took his specific approach, which is basically a plant-based diet approach, and addressed individuals with prostate cancer and showed that he could slow the rate of rise in individuals who had had a prostate cancer. So we do know that diet probably indeed does, and I'm talking about once a diagnosis is made, probably does affect the rate of change of prostate cancer. There is some evidence that certain types of vegetables will or may affect such things. And there's broccoli contains a substance called glucoraphanin, which will be converted to a substance called sulforaphane when you eat the broccoli. And that sulforaphane has extremely interesting properties in the body. In fact, Johns Hopkins Chemoprotection Lab, so there's actually a laboratory at Johns Hopkins Hospital that has been investigating the effects of certain types of naturally occurring plant-based compounds for a number of years now. One of them is sulforaphane, and they've got some studies out showing, again, in individuals with diagnosed prostate cancer that they can slow the rate of rise of PSA with a extract of broccoli sprouts. So, you know, with regard to whether you should be eating broccoli sprouts, I certainly don't think it can hurt you. And, would it affect your PSA? Difficult to know. I mean, there is some preliminary data that it could, and eating a plant-based diet indeed could affect your PSA rise, even if you didn't have a prostate cancer.
Bill, what's your number?
Oh, it was about 4.5.
Okay, so at 65, that's just mildly elevated. But if you have a family history of prostate cancer, then your urologist is probably. Did you see a urologist yet with regard to this?
No, I haven't got that far. I'm sort of at the what do they call it? Watchful waiting. I'm going to be retested in 3 months.
Yeah. So if sometimes these things bump around quite a bit. So you'll see one value goes to 4.5 and then the next value is down at 3.2. So, you have to see a consistent, elevation in order to be concerned. What was your last prior PSA? By the way, for folks out in our audience, PSA refers to prostate specific antigen, which is a blood test we use to track risk for prostate cancer. What was your last prior PSA?
Well, it was a number of years ago, and then I guess the medical establishment decided that PSA wasn't all that useful, so there was a number of years between the two. So it may have been 4 or 5 years ago, but it was somewhere 2.5, something like that.
Okay, so you're generally allowed about 0.8 per nanogram elevation per year. So, you know, it sounds like it's still in a reasonable range. It's, I think, useful for rate of change more than anything else, but I would agree with the national data that, and actually it's more than just national data, it's world data, that it may not be the best test to do to determine risk. That said, it's done by quite a few urologists in the United States, and I think, you know, if it can identify early disease, and if that then that disease can be watched more closely as opposed to operated upon, you know, if it's low risk disease, then I think PSA would serve a purpose, you know, rather than just not do it at all.
So digital is still
is still done, and it should be done. To you can have a you know, identify a nodule on the prostate using a digital rectal exam. But the PSA should also be used in conjunction.
Yeah, I believe you and I do it. Okay, thank you, Bill. Appreciate it. All right, let's go now to Cynthia, who's been patiently waiting for us. Okay, Cynthia, you're on.
Hi, gentlemen. It's awfully nice to talk with you. I have severe osteoporosis. I'm 57. I did have surgery 10 years ago, which is what plunged me immediately into menopause. And my T-score in my hips is minus 3.5. And I'm wondering if can I actually change that, or am I just going to stay there? I'm currently taking Forteo, and so I'm just wondering.
Yeah, you can absolutely change
it.
Sure, you can increase your bone density with medication. There's no question about it. Are you taking calcium?
Yes, I'm taking 600 milligrams with vitamin D3.
Good. And have you had a vitamin D level done?
Yes, I don't remember the number, but I know it's a good level. I have enough.
Okay, so that sounds reasonable. What are your risk factors for osteoporosis? Do you smoke?
No, I don't smoke. I did have a partial hysterectomy, and that was 10 years ago. And then the past 2 years, because of a family death and all that involved, I wasn't able to lift weights or work out or do much. All I was able to do was walk, and that obviously didn't help me.
Well, you know, that's interesting that you should bring that up. As compared to lifting weights, walking is probably superior. Okay, however,
really?
You have to walk. If you buy an expensive pair of walking shoes, you're probably not doing yourself as much benefit. There has to be a shock wave created when your heel strikes the ground that sends that shock wave up through the axial skeleton is what actually drives calcium into bone. There was a study done a number of years ago that if you bought a high-end walking shoe, people were not shown to improve their scores as well as individuals who had more inexpensive shoes. The only thing I would tell you is if you buy a pair of inexpensive shoes and then decide you're going to go out and walk 10 miles, you might end up with bad plantar fasciitis and you won't be able to walk at all. So you have to work up to it.
Paul, do you have any sense of what the minimum one should walk is?
As much as you can, but I would say, you know, there is no minimum. I would say probably, you know, when we say folks 10,000 steps a day, we're talking about 4.7 to 5 miles a day. I think that's probably optimal, you know. But in someone who is, you know, wants to, you know, treat osteoporosis, I think, you know, the more they can do, the better up to that point. Whether walking more than 5 miles a day, I don't know the data exists.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, well, thank you. That's a great call,
Cynthia. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. See, every once in a while I learn something on this program that I didn't know. And it never had occurred to me that, you know, sneakers or walking shoes that were not as good could be preferable.
It's interesting because if you recall the old PF Flyers, you know, they're basically canvas and rubber. Those were found to be the best shoe for walking with regard to you know, increasing bone density. Again, the problem is as you get older and you start walking in shoes that are minimally padded like that, you end up getting plantar fasciitis, and then you can't walk at all.
Interesting. Yeah, well, you know, one of our more popular Medical Mondays is always with feet. People have a lot. People have a lot of issues with feet.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Okay, so we did that. Okay, now we're going to go hanging on the longest, and that's the way I do this, is to go to Howard in Lake George. Okay, Howard, you're on.
Can you hear me?
We can.
Good. I'm actually a family physician, and I would love to know. I get very frustrated by pulling into gas stations when you can get 3 20-ounce sodas for $3 and seeing the TV ads for 2 Big Macs for $5, 3 for $3 at Kentucky Fried Chicken, and so on and so forth. I would love to hear your colleagues' strategies for how we as a nation might be able to bend the curve around these foods being less costly than the healthier foods. Maybe getting people to buy more rice and beans, which in underdeveloped countries, you see very little obesity. So this is what we're up against as clinicians, the entire culture and economy of our lifestyle.
I agree with you 100%. You know, there is, and you know, it's like anything else. I don't think that there was any malintent initially, you know, by the food industry to produce foods that were necessarily bad for folks. I think, however, that whenever we get away from more natural manifestations of food, you know, stuff in boxes and cans and products, whenever we start moving in the direction of products, we're moving away, that we're talking about refinement of food. And whenever we talk about refinement of food, we're talking about a fuel that was not what the human machine was meant to process and to use. So I agree with you 100%. I think the best way to do this, since obesity is a not just a medical problem, it's a sociological problem, as you imply. I think that the way to address it is from a sociological perspective, but by the same token, I think the easiest way to do that is to encourage people, first of all, to teach them what a healthy diet is, and second, to encourage folks to get back to cooking, you know, and actually preparing stuff for themselves. I mean, Americans go out 3 or 4 times a week to eat on average, and this is not going to give you what you really need. You know, certainly cultivating within our young people an interest in cooking, an interest in shopping and buying healthy foods, and doing it in a way, of course, that is both tasty and efficient, so you don't have to spend a lot of time in a kitchen, I think is, you know, as people develop friendships and communities that suggest these type things are of benefit, I think it's all to the good. And it starts in the schools, but it also starts in the home, you know, and people have to start to educate themselves on proper nutrition.
Yeah, but the Howard's question, which is so good, as you know, is how do you get them to do it? You've given classes yourself.
And that's how you do it. I think, you know, again, you're not going to get everybody to change behavior, because people are free spirits. They're going to do what they want to do. That said, an individual who doesn't want to take a blood pressure medicine, an individual doesn't want to take a cholesterol medicine, an individual who's had problems with those medications, an individual who's seen a family member suffering from diabetes, an individual who's been told they have prediabetes themselves, these are the individuals who are perhaps at higher risk or have more motivation to make changes and to look to those places in the area and to those clinicians in the area who can help teach them how to make those changes.
But I have friends who will not do that.
Of course, we all do.
And they all have the same thing. Their parents died at an early age.
And you know, again, it's the early adopters, Alan. You know, they're the ones that we're going to try and influence first. And then there's some critical mass that will be reached, and that's how society changes. It doesn't change because everybody decides everything is that this is a superior way to go and we're all going to change at once. It happens because people make changes and other people see those changes and see that they can do it as well.
Well, because we have doctors like both of you. Thank you, Howard. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank
you. Okay, we'll go now to B in Saugerties. B in Saugerties on line number 2. B, you're on.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can.
Great. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate what you're saying about diet and lifestyle, how important it is, and also how difficult it is. I've been vegetarian for 30 years. Ate a lot of processed carbs and broccoli. And living up here, I have a lot more needs for calories and good nutrition. And I'm learning, you know, do it yourself, learning how to cook. And a lot of the foods are really expensive and they're not local. You know, I find the coconut is really good. I eat the whole rye bread. Doing sprouts can be tricky. So it's a challenge.
So B, we're up against the break. Is there something you want to ask?
Yeah. First of all, I wanted to just reply firstly to the woman that called with the Lymes. And I had a couple bars in my blood test some years back, and I did the antibiotics, and then I did a 48-hour green juice fast to get rid of any remaining bacteria in my system. And since then, about 99%, I will not eat sugar, white sugar, as in like commercial processed sugar, and I will not eat wheat or yeast. I won't use
Okay,
yeast.
We are up against a break. Paul, can
so
you
that's
ask?
Really, okay, Alan, that's really helped me.
Okay, good. We got it.
That diet change. And my question is just about these super papaya enzymes and about taking supplements. And if there's any, you know, if there's any backlash from taking the chewable enzyme.
Okay,
wait.
Before you answer, Paul, we're going to have to take a break. B, stay right on the phone. We'll be right with you, okay?
Okay, thanks.
Support comes from the Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences in the Capital District and beyond. Skidmore.edu/Tang. Boyden and Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, providing foreign and domestic car, truck, and SUV repair services and a Massachusetts inspection station for over 50 years. BoydenandPerrin.com. Interactive Media Consulting, a team of online market strategists providing websites, branding, and digital marketing to the Capital Region and beyond. Since 1996, imediaconsult.com. Gear Village, a senior community where one can age in a supportive environment at all stages of life. GearVillage.com for information. And from Dr. Lucy Chapik, Latham, New York, a plastic surgeon dedicated to aesthetic cosmetic surgery, fat transfers, facial rejuvenation, laser, and skin care since 1996. A surgeon's hands, a woman's touch. 518-786-1700.
Okay, we're back. B, we'll let Dr. Lemansky take it up where we left. Go ahead, Paul.
Well, I don't really believe in supplements. To be honest, I believe individuals should be eating whole foods and organically produced if possible and if they can afford it. That said, there are some things that are difficult to get. For example, vitamin D, I think, has to be taken as a pill if you can't get exposure to sunlight and or it's a risk for you to be exposed to sunlight. And as far as papaya enzymes, I don't know of any data that would argue that they're not a reasonable thing to do if you get some benefit from it. There certainly, I don't think, appears to be much in the way of any risk to it. But I'm also not clear that there is any randomized clinical trial data proving that it's beneficial in any specific conditions.
Okay, well, the big one is actually the B12. as vegetarian.
Right. All all vegans, not vegetarians, but all vegans would require B12 supplementation. Vegetarians who would get some milk or eggs or this kind of product which contained B12 would be able to avoid having to take a supplementation of B12.
So if you take B12, how should you take it?
Well, as a pill. You could take it as a spray under the tongue. It goes right into the bloodstream. That's expensive. I'm a big believer in the least expensive that works. So, you know,
do you know of anything that's in literature about supplements that would,
I'm so sorry. We got a loaded board here and we're going to have to stop it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go to, Jim in Schenectady. You've been patiently waiting. Okay, Jim, you're on.
Hi. I agree with Alan about the bariatric surgery. I actually had bariatric surgery November of 15, and I left the hospital 3 days later taking no medication at all for my diabetes, and my A1C has been at 5.0 ever since.
Well, that's fine. That's good. You know, the issue has to do with what the number of islet cells that are in your pancreas could we elicit, if we did a glucose tolerance test on you, would that be a completely normal test? How long had you been diabetic for?
Oh, 10 years plus.
Okay.
That's amazing.
I was on six oral medications.
Yeah, we have, by the way, this is not just an argument or a disagreement that people have in the lay community. I have disagreements with surgeons about this all the time because they like to use the terminology cure. There are definite changes that occur with bariatric surgery that occur before the weight loss actually is accomplished. Okay. So their argument has to do with, well, therefore something else is going on other than simply weight loss. And there is other stuff going on, but I will tell you that the islet cells do not reproduce. And that if we believe, and I think we're pretty well on fairly solid ground in saying this, that type 2 diabetes is a process where the islet cell function is lost and not recovered because the cells are lost and not recovered. If there were subsets of patients where it was not so much loss as much as it was some sort of dysfunction, and then you were able to get that back, then possibly further research will show that there are people out there like yourself who maybe indeed could get back function without necessarily getting, you know, reproducing more cell or
except,
producing more
except
cells.
Except that he's showing no sign of classical signs of diabetes.
Well, yeah, I don't know how fast his A1C went to 5.4. We'd have to look at it, Al. But I'm going to tell you that the notion of saying cure with regard to diabetes.
Yeah, I wouldn't say cure.
My doctor used the word remission.
I think that's a safe word to use. And again, because it reflects the fact that we don't know absolutely with exact certainty exactly what's happening in all individuals who have this condition.
So all of this started because somebody called up Medical Monday and said, how do you get rid of body fat? That little rim of fat that you have around below your tummy. And I laughed and I said, you don't eat. For a while, and then I began to think about this bariatric surgery and what Jim is telling us, mm-hmm. and wondering, because there's something new called cold sculpting, yeah,
yep.
Which seems to make a difference with people.
Well, it makes a difference with what you see on the surface of your abdominal wall. Remember, yes. Alan, that the little pouch that we all have, and I got one right over here.
Really?
Okay, yeah.
You don't look
I'm not going to show
you. You look like the ass.
The little pouch that we all have around the belly button, okay, that is simply a marker for internal fat, which is really what causes the metabolic derangement of diabetes and prediabetes. Okay, so if studies have been done, for example, liposucting.
Yes.
That fat out.
Yes.
Does not change your glucose tolerance test, does not change any of your metabolic parameters.
So then why the
Jim has had a procedure that's actually affected those internal fat structures. Well, a gastric bypass is going to affect your internal fat, not just the external fat. The external fat is what we all see.
Right, right, right.
That's not what's causing the metabolic derangement. It's the internal fat, which is a representation of the external fat, that is really what we're correcting.
Jim, I really want to say thank you for making this call. I feel vindicated.
Well, and if anyone's been fighting type 2 diabetes for a long time, go see a bariatric surgeon.
Now, let me ask you this. Were you on insulin?
I was being suggested to go on.
All right.
I was on.
All right. So what I'm going to suggest, Alan, is this gentleman never required insulin or was at the threshold of requiring insulin.
Right.
That means he still had cells, islet cells, that were producing insulin.
Yes.
If he lost all his islet cells,
yes.
Okay, so he was off of oral agents, only on insulin, if he then had bariatric surgery, there would be no... You would still have to require insulin to treat.
Jim, thanks for the call. Okay, we'll go to Andrew in Berkshire County. All right, Andrew, you're on.
Hi, I was just wondering if you had any experience or thoughts on the whole low-calorie, calorie restriction and longevity for eating once a day type of diet plans that I've come across.
Low calorie, yes, but not necessarily achieved through once a day eating. Low calorie. So, for our listeners, it's been observed in multiple different organisms, not necessarily in humans yet, but in multiple different animals, including nematode worms, that. About a 20% restriction in caloric intake prolongs life. Now, whether people would say, well, yeah, I'm living longer, but I'm miserable because I can't eat, that is a decision you have to, you know, make on for yourself. But there is evidence in animals anyway that caloric restriction will extend life.
So there are doctors who will tell you, diabetic doctors who will tell you, you really have to eat three meals a day. Is that wrong?
No. I don't know of any specific data with regard to once a day eating to achieve that. I'm talking about total caloric restriction.
Yeah, got it.
Over a day, many days. The total caloric restriction.
I came across this research online. I don't know how legitimate it was, but this guy was basically saying that the three meals a day. It's more of a society type thing, and it's not actually how our ancestors ate because food was so scarce. So I don't know. What are your thoughts on
that?
Well,
they didn't live to 100 years old either.
Yeah, they were eaten by wild animals, I guess. But there is some rationale to saying that. Now, whether or not we don't know exactly how our ancestors ate, I know I get a little bit testy if I skip meals.
Okay, well, thank you for that call. We got an interesting letter from Ann who says, what does the doctor think of a paleo, there you go, or a Whole30 diet? In other words, no grains, no sugar, limited diet, dairy, lots of fruits and vegetables, and high-quality protein. Feels so much better after this. I've lost 15 pounds, but my lipid levels were unchanged after 1 month. My gastroenterologist, my primary care doctor were in favor of staying as close to this food plan as possible. What do you think?
I mean, look, I'm a proponent of a plant-based diet, okay?
Right.
Primarily plant-based.
Do you eat meat?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Predominantly plant-based diet does not exclude meat. So humans are omnivorous creatures. We're not vegan necessarily. Perfect argument for that is if you're a vegan, you have to supply yourself with B12. Therefore, historically, we were not vegan.
Yeah, got it.
The same thing can be said of the way that our teeth are. We have incisors for cutting, and we have back wisdom teeth and molars for grinding. I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with any diet that restricts total calories so as to result in weight loss. I don't think that grain is necessarily a good thing, because if you think about it, grain is only about 10,000 years old. That's not long enough to have altered our biochemistry in any way. And so if we tend to overload ourselves with carbohydrate, grain-based, or even sugars, I think that's a bad thing.
Okay, we only have a few minutes left. We have about seven, less than that, left. So keep your questions short, and doctor will answer as quickly as he can. We'll go to Charlie in Oneonta. Okay, Charlie on line seven, you're on.
Hi, this is a follow-up on PSA. I'm 66 now, and when I was 50, I had a PSA test, and the number was 11. They were all kind of aghast, and I had another one done a month later, and it was still 11. So I had a biopsy done, and everything was clear, no problem. Since then, I've had tests, and it hasn't changed at all. And I'm just wondering, is it the baseline that you start from? And also, why should I have had such a high level to begin with?
I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, typically, if it isn't a cancer of the prostate causing PSA to go up, it's either one of two things. It's either benign prostatic hypertrophy, meaning your prostate was large at that time, or it was prostatitis, which is an infection of the prostate, and that can elevate PSA as well.
But it's still there. In other words, he's still at 11.
You could have a chronic prostatitis for years.
Oh, interesting.
Many years. And you can have BPH for many years. So
without any symptoms?
That's a difficult question to answer. Certainly, you'd expect the probability would be higher that there would be symptoms than not.
And those symptoms would be going to the bathroom a lot? And then
increased frequency of urination, decreased stream of urine. Yeah.
Okay, thank you for that. All right, now we're going to go to Cheryl in New Paltz. Okay, Cheryl in New Paltz, you got to make it quick. Go ahead.
Okay, hi. I have a 16-year-old vegetarian daughter who's interested in going into the field of either a dietitian or nutrition, and we're just starting to explore it. Can you speak, I guess, briefly to the outlook, the diversity, and the salary in those fields?
Well, I really can't speak to, you know, the salaries in those fields, other than that dietitians are grossly underpaid for what they do. And I don't see any real change necessarily occurring in that, which is unfortunate. The field of nutrition suffers from, numerous so-called experts who have no scientific background, no training in nutrition, and unfortunately are able to get the attention of a whole host of different individuals, and so undermine the field of the registered dietitian, and make it more difficult for a registered dietitian to have both an impact in medical practice, I think, and in general. People don't necessarily go to a registered dietitian on their own. They go to many different types of nutritionists, but not necessarily a registered dietitian, which is a shame.
Cheryl, thank you. Okay, we're going to go to, very quickly, this will have to be the last call, and that will be Diane in Saugerties. All right, Diane, it's got to be short. I mean really short. And Paul, we've got to be a short answer. Go ahead.
I was diagnosed at age 66 with type 2 diabetes. I didn't fit the profile. I wasn't obese. I ate a healthy diet, although with what I know now, it was high in carbs, but there was it was whole grains and fruit. And I sometimes people just develop diabetes, and it's not something they did wrong. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And I was told that I have anti-GAD antibodies, and I don't really understand that.
Very quickly, Paul, maybe a sentence.
No, nope. I'm not sure.
Paul's
what that's
out on the
street.
I'm so sorry we can't spend more time with you, Diane. We are out of time now, and we'll give Wanda. Wanda, you got to make it really fast. Go ahead.
Yes, I have been getting steroid shots in my back for a number of years. I hear that they are bad for you, and this is because of chronic back pain. I haven't found anything to tell me if it is a bad thing. Can you give me an answer on that?
Anytime you're taking steroids chronically for whatever reason, whether it's by injection or orally, it's not a good thing. It's going to undermine your bone density at a minimum. Also, it's going to affect your blood sugar, and it's going to affect your cholesterol levels.
Thank you, Wanda. Okay, Paul, thank you for that very quick answer. I know I pushed you to do that, and I want to thank everybody who called. We are out of time. Underwriting for support for Medical Monday comes from Amherst Copy and Design Works, offering printing and copying, sign making, and design service from booklets to stationery and labels to lawn signs in downtown Amherst, Massachusetts, amherstcopy.com. Thanks again for joining us, and thanks to Paul Lemansky. Always love having you here, Paul. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.